You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Colorado Springs Gazette, read to you by Brian Juergens. And I'm reading this on January 20th, 2026. I'll be reading the following main articles. Is President's Greenland threat linked to failure to win Nobel Peace Prize? POLIS's local officers can and should work with DEA agents amid non-cooperation law. That's written by Michael Barthwaite, Marianne Goodland, and Luigi Del Puerto. And Coalition Moves Pinnacle Fight to the Voters, written by Marianne Goodland. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Let's begin. Is President's Greenland threat linked to failure to win Nobel Peace Prize? And I'm reading these articles to you in order of the amount of comments that they have gotten online, and this story leads the way with 61 comments. EU plans to retaliate if Trump enacts tariffs for not supporting his plan. And this is out of Paris. President Donald Trump has linked his drive to take control of Greenland to his future win, to his failure to win the Nobel Peace Prize, saying he no longer thought, quote, purely of peace, end quote, as the row over the island threatens to reignite a trade war with Europe. Trump declined to tell NBC News in an interview whether he would use force to seize Greenland. He reiterated his threat to enact tariffs on European nations if a deal is not reached. Trump has intensified his push to wrest sovereignty over Greenland from fellow NATO member Denmark, prompting the European Union to weigh hitting back with its own measures. The dispute threatens to upend the NATO alliance that has underpinned Western security for decades and which was already under strain due to the war in Ukraine and Trump's refusal to protect allies unless they increase defense spending. Trump's threat has rattled European industry and sent shockwaves through financial markets. Investors fear a return to the volatility of 2025's trade war, which only eased when the sides reached tariff deals in the middle of the year. In a text message on Sunday to Norway's Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre, Trump said, "Considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8 wars plus, all in caps, I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace, although it will always be predominant, but can now think about what is good and proper for the United States of America." Norway's government released the messages on Monday. Støre had sent an initial message with Finnish President Alexander Stubb calling for a de-escalation of tensions, eliciting a response from Trump less than half an hour later. Nobel Committee gave Peace Prize to Machado. The Norwegian Nobel Committee annoyed Trump by awarding the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize not to him, but to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. In his message, Trump also repeated his accusation that Denmark cannot protect Greenland from Russia or China. Quote, "And why do they have a right of ownership anyway?" he wrote, adding, "The world is not secure unless we have complete and total control of Greenland," end quote. Trump vowed on Saturday to implement a wave of increasing tariffs on February 1st on EU members Denmark, Sweden, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Finland, along with Britain and Norway, until the U.S. is allowed to buy Greenland, home to only 57,000 people. "We are living in 2026. You can trade with people, but you don't trade people, Denmark's Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen said during a visit to London on Monday. In a post on Facebook, Greenland Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen said the territory should be allowed to decide its own fate. "We will not let ourselves be pressured. We stand firm on dialogue, on respect, and on international law," he said. Denmark's military told Reuters that Danish soldiers would land in Kangerlussuaq, Western Greenland, on Monday as part of the Arctic Endurance military exercise. Talks with Trump in Davos? Norway's Stor said he would change his schedule to attend the World Economic Forum in Davos on Wednesday and Thursday, overlapping with Trump's planned appearance at the annual gathering of the global political and business elite. The country will not change its stance on Greenland, the country's foreign minister, Epson Barth Eide, said. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said he too would try to meet Trump on Wednesday, adding that a trade dispute was not wanted. But if we are confronted with tariffs that we consider unreasonable, then we are capable of responding, Merz said. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said it would be, quote, very unwise, end quote, for European governments to retaliate. Polis. Local officers can, should, work with DEA agents amid non-cooperation law. This was written by three different reporters, Michael Braithwright, Marianne Goodland, and Luigi Del Preto. And the story begins with a photo of Governor Polis standing in the Capitol building. He's behind the lectern. There's a large clock above him. It's kind of a mint green back wall behind him, and then it's got cream-colored curtains beside that. The American flag is to his right and the Colorado flag to his left. There's an individual standing up to his left, looks like he's clapping his hands, and there's a multitude of people in the audience. They're all standing, so I assume some sort of standing ovation is going on. There are folding chairs at the ends of each bench for additional seating, but it doesn't look like they're being used. And the caption reads, Governor Jared Polis delivers his final State of the State address to the joint members of the Colorado General Assembly at the state capitol on Thursday. And now to the story. Governor Jared Polis on Friday insisted that local law enforcement officers in Colorado can, and should, work with federal drug enforcement authorities to go after criminal activity. An official of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency earlier said Colorado's quote-unquote sanctuary laws, notably its prohibition against cooperating with federal authorities on illegal immigration matters, are having a chilling effect on law enforcement's ability to pursue drug cartels operating in the state. Quote, there's always a matter of making sure local line officers are educated in our laws and that they know that they're able to work with our federal partners on criminal matters, end quote, Polis told the Gazette. So it doesn't shock me that there are some line officers somewhere that didn't know they're able to work with law enforcement federally on criminal investigations. But generally, we hope our sheriffs and our police chiefs are doing a good job, making sure that we can work closely with our federal partners. I'll be happy to talk to them, he added, so I'll set that up. David Oleski, the special agent in charge of the Drug Enforcement Administration's DEA Rocky Mountain Field Division, earlier said that local law enforcers are hesitant to even ask for standard information, such as the name and date of birth of those possibly affiliated with drug activity, out of fear their action could later be used against them by the state. Local and state authorities are fearful that the state is going to come back to them, that the passing of their information, even though it originated in drugs, is going to cause civil liability, where they can get sued up to $50,000, Oleski said. On May 23rd, Polis signed into law Senate Bill 25-276, which, at its core, re-emphasized existing state law that precludes local law enforcers from detaining an individual based on an, quote, immigration detainer, end quote. State statutes already prohibit an employee of the state agency from disclosing any identifying information of a person to assist with immigration enforcement. The new legislation extended that to employees of all political subdivisions, such as home rule, counties, and municipalities. The law, which imposes a civil fine of $50,000 for each violation, includes an exemption for criminal investigations. Backers of the non-cooperation law have long argued that Colorado's local police officers should not be commandeered to conduct the work of federal immigration authorities. Others have raised worries about violating due process rights for immigrants living illegally in the country who might be swept up in the Trump administration's illegal immigration crackdown. Critics of the quote-unquote sanctuary statutes, meanwhile, countered that they made it more difficult for local law enforcement to work with federal agents to interdict crime, and that ultimately negatively affects residents, whether they are in the country illegally or not. Colorado's drug sanctuary label comes amid rising tensions between local and federal law enforcement in Colorado, especially after Attorney General Phil Weiser filed a lawsuit against a Mesa County Sheriff's Office deputy for providing a woman's personal information to federal officials during a traffic stop. The woman arrested, a University of Utah student, was born in Brazil, came to the U.S. under a tourist visa when she was 7, and has been living in Utah for 12 years. She overstayed her visa about a decade ago and has a pending asylum case. A Mesa County judge dismissed the case after the sheriff's deputy resigned from his position and promised not to work for another law enforcement agency in the state, according to local news reports. The deputy, along with several other officers, had been placed on unpaid leave and reassigned from a drug task force. Court documents and an investigative report into the case had offered glimpses into how local and federal agents interact along America's major corridors. Notably, the practice of sharing information about interdictions to other agencies appeared routine, and when the subject of a police stop is in the country illegally, immigration agents showed up to detain the individual, according to documents. But that practice of information sharing, a sore point of contention in other parts of the state, notably in Denver, whose political leaders had perennially balked at cooperating with immigration agents unless the case is criminal in nature, is evolving, particularly following the passage of Colorado's latest law. Already, the Colorado State Patrol said it will stop communicating via a signal chat channel shared by local officers and federal drug and immigration agents. Last month, Oleski, the DEA agent, said Colorado's approach toward crime and illegal immigration has changed over the years. Cartel members said Colorado es un santuario. Colorado is a sanctuary, he said. They know Denver es un santuario. If they get arrested by the feds here, they know they will go. But if they get arrested by the state, their immigration status means nothing. Of particular worry to Oleski is that Denver is, quote, on the verge of breaking, end quote, drug activity records, while the rest of the country is headed in the other direction. Polis once anew rejected the label sanctuary state. In our state, we share criminal information with our federal partners nearly every day in some way, shape, or form. And whether the suspects are here legally or illegally doesn't matter, he said. We're fully able to cooperate on apprehending suspects, whether their presence here is legal or illegal. The Rocky Mountain region saw record-breaking amounts of fentanyl pills and methamphetamines seized in 2025, according to DEA officials. The seizures, a 76% increase compared to the year before, accounted for $6.7 million, or over 14% of the 47 million pills seized by the DEA throughout the U.S., federal authorities said. Meanwhile, fatal fentanyl overdoses in Denver rose by nearly 25% last year to the second highest total in the past half decade. 346 people died, up from 277 the year before. Coalition moves pinnacle fight to the voters. Written by Marianne Goodland. The future of Pinnacle Assurance is moving away from the governor's office and the legislature with a new ballot initiative aiming to privatize the insurer and use the proceeds to expand job training across Colorado. Colorado Succeeds, a coalition of business leaders focused on education, is pursuing a ballot measure to allow Pinnacle, the quasi-government workers' compensation insurer, to go private, effective in 2027. Colorado Succeed's CEO, Scott LaBand, told Colorado Politics that his members, business leaders across the state, are looking for workforce development. "We're all about Coloradans being educated to their greatest potential and all companies having that local, homegrown talent that they need to thrive," he said. Colorado Succeeds has been providing scholarships along with foundations for short-term credential training. Its leaders said it has had a significant impact on employees and employers. "The group wants a way to stabilize it through public investment," LaBond said, noting that this kind of training is often underfunded. When it looked at Pinnacle, the group concluded its Colorado Legacy asset that deals with the workforce, LaBand said. "Pinnacle's community work is similar to Colorado Succeed's efforts, and we saw an opportunity for a once-in-a-generation windfall for the state in workforce development," he said. LaBand said the group approached Pinnacle with the idea, which was received positively, he said. This is the most exciting opportunity I've ever seen to create something that has staying power, will meaningfully impact individuals' lives, and ensure the economy moves forward," LaBand said. The ballot measure also includes accountability measures, he added. The measure's principal proposal is to allow Pinnacle to go private effective July 1st, 2027. As envisioned, $150 million of the money will go to community colleges, local district, and area technical schools to fund a grant program to be known as the Skilled Workers and Trades Fund for in-demand jobs, such as plumbers, electricians, and nurses. It would also fund capital equipment improvements. Additionally, the premium taxes that Pinnacle pays to the state general fund would be routed to the grant program to fund staffing and ensure sustainability. LaBand estimated that it would cost about $10 million per year. The $150 million would be drawn down at approximately 5% per year, resulting in an annual payout of about $17.5 million. About 10% will go toward administrative costs and data collection. That leaves enough to fund 5,000 scholarships per year at $3,000 each. "The learning partners are ecstatic about that," says LaBand. While the ballot measure doesn't set a dollar amount, it allows Pinnacle to separate its employees from the Public Employees Retirement Association, PERA, the state pension plan. PERA has valued Pinnacle's exit, under which Pinnacle would pay $302 million for its employees' pension share. Pinnacle previously claimed that it was too rich for its liking. The valuation from PERA is based on a discount rate, which pension plans use to estimate the present value of future pensions. PERA proposes a 5.25% rate. Pinnacle prefers 7.25%, which would result in a lower cost to exit PERA, potentially by $150 million. Pinnacle CEO John O'Donnell told Colorado Politics that PERA will get the $302 million, given that Pinnacle will be able to privatize under the ballot measure for far less than the deal proposed by the governor. Pinnacle's board has not yet taken an official position on the ballot measure and is reviewing the legal documents tied to the proposal, he said. That said, with Pinnacle engaged in workforce development, quote, "We feel this is a really good fit for us, potentially, and are encouraged by the opportunity," end quote. "We're tasked with doing what's in the best interest of our members, policyholders, and the workers of Colorado," O'Donnell said. "Our workers' compensation system is funded by the premiums paid by our members, and if we can get more training in these different vocations, that tends to improve the safety, reduce injuries, and results in lower workers' compensation costs. That's a win for them." The ballot measure takes a very different approach to Pinnacle privatization than the governor has proposed over the past year. Governor Jared Polis, in his 2026-27 budget proposal, included privatization in hopes of the state gaining about $400 million from the deal, which would, in part, pay for the 2026 homestead property tax exemption for seniors and disabled veterans, $193 million. In a statement to Colorado Politics, a spokesman said that the governor has not seen the ballot language and will review it if it makes the ballot. The governor agrees that Pinnacle, for long-term sustainability, needs to be converted to a private entity. We feel that the legislature has an opportunity to address this issue this legislative session, the spokesperson said. There's another idea. Pinnacle could be sold to the highest bidder. That deal could be worth up to $800 million to the state, although Pinnacle has said it is not legal. Polis told reporters he isn't opposed to the idea, but is not advocating for it. In a November statement, the company said that the state doesn't own Pinnacle, so the state can't offer the insurance company for sale. Pinnacle mostly separated from the state in 2002, when the state directed Pinnacle to operate as an independent mutual insurance company under the ownership of its members, the company said. The company added that Pinnacle intends to maintain, quote, its financial strength and capital to meet the needs of our members while remaining under the ownership of our members. This commitment is non-negotiable, end quote. Pinnacle has been seeking privatization for years. Going private would allow it to offer its insurance products beyond the state's borders to Colorado companies with employees in other states. 25 states, including Colorado, have laws prohibiting a political subdivision, such as Pinnacle, from being licensed as an insurance carrier in their state. Pinnacle officials said a year ago that half of Colorado employers have employees outside Colorado, and given that it cannot offer insurance to those out-of-state workers, those companies, as many as 95%, are going elsewhere. That leaves Pinnacle with more high-risk companies, which carry higher premiums and, over the long term, reduce the services it can offer as its market share continues to drop, according to company sources. While Pinnacle remains the largest provider of workers' compensation insurance in Colorado, it is losing market share, now below 50%, the company said last year. The Stiddy Bus is rolling. Broncos confident in backup quarterback Jarrett Stidham against the Patriots. Written by Chris Thomason. And this story has three different photos, and several of them are older, so I'm just going to read the captions because that's going to best describe them. The first shows Stidham taking a snap, and he's in Denver uniform with the throwback jerseys and helmets. He's in orange and blue with white pants. And then the other photos show him in gameplay. The first says Broncos quarterback Jarrett Stidham briefly looks up at the stadium before the start of a play during the first half, December 31st, 2024, at Empower Field at Mile High in Denver. Stidham started in place of Russell Wilson, who was benched with two games remaining in the regular season. This season, Stidham is wearing number 8, and he was wearing number 4 in that photo. And then the other photo is from when he was playing with the Patriots, and he's wearing a red jersey and blue pants, the Patriots helmet, also wearing the number 4. Coach Belichick is standing next to him, and the caption reads, New England Patriots head coach Bill Belichick, center, speaks with quarterback Brian Hoyer, number 5, as quarterback Jarrett Stidham, number 4, warms up during a practice on November 10th, 2021 in Foxborough, Massachusetts. And now to the story. Jarrett Stidham now can get behind the wheel of the Stiddy Bus. In 2020, after Tom Brady bolted as a free agent to Tampa Bay, Stidham was considered the favorite by many to become New England's starting quarterback. Scott Zolak, a former Patriots quarterback who is now a broadcaster in Boston, has told the Denver Gazette that on his NBC Sports Boston show, then was a graphic of the Stiddy Bus, in which the second-year quarterback was shown driving a bus and hitting the horn and going, beep, beep. Alas, Stidham ended up being the backup that season after the Patriots elected to sign free agent Cam Newton just before the start of training camp. In 2021, with Newton gone, Stidham again was hopeful of being the Patriots' starter, but he had back surgery in July, and rookie Mac Jones got the nod. In 2023, Stidham started the final two regular season games for the Broncos, after Russell Wilson was benched and he had hopes of being their starter in 2024. But he was beaten out by rookie Bo Nix. Nix, though, suffered a season-ending broken right ankle in last Saturday's 33-30 overtime win over Buffalo in a divisional playoff game that will have surgery Tuesday in Birmingham, Alabama, performed by Dr. Norman E. Waldrop. So, Stidham will be the starter for Sunday's AFC Championship game at Empower Field at Mile High against the Patriots, his former team. He's been waiting for this moment for the entirety of his career, Broncos tackle Mike McGinchley said Monday. I think he's more prepared than anybody would be in this situation, and he can ball. He can flat out play quarterback, and we've seen it every single day at practice. Stidham has just 4 NFL starts in his 7 seasons. In addition to his close the 2023 season, he started the final 2 games in 2022 for Las Vegas when the Raiders had decided to move on from Derek Carr. With Stidham having thrown for 365 yards and 3 touchdowns in his first start against San Francisco in Week 17, that was enough for Sean Payton to bring the quarterback to Denver when Payton took over as the Broncos coach in 2023. Despite Stidham's limited number of starts, Payton and Denver players are very confident in Stiddy, who got his nickname from Brady after he joined the Patriots in 2019 as a 4th-round pick. We have full faith in Stiddy, said defensive lineman Zach Allen. He's the first guy in the building every day. He prepares like a starter, so we're really excited to see what he does. He's really, really smart. He studies it. He's like a second quarterback coach out there. On top of that, too, he can make every single throw. We're lucky to have him. But also on Monday, Allen lamented the loss of Nix. Obviously, Bo was a huge part of us getting to this point, Allen said. We feel terrible for him, and all of our well wishes go to him. We know he'll come back stronger than ever when he gets healthy. Nix, who started all 34 regular season games and 2 playoff games in his first 2 seasons, was injured on a play that began with 6 minutes 4 seconds left in overtime when he was tackled by Cole Bishop for a 2-yard loss on a designed run. Nix remained in the game for 2 more plays before limping to the sideline prior to Will Lutz kicking the winning 23-yard field goal with 4 minutes 44 seconds left in overtime for the exhilarating win at Empower Field. After the game, Payton, Broncos general manager George Patton, quarterbacks coach Davis Webb, medical officials, and members of Nix's family were among those in a hallway when news was delivered about the extent of the quarterback's injury. Nix's wife, Izzy, posted a photo of the gathering Monday on social media and wrote that the two will be, quote, on the front row, cheering the loudest as the playoffs continue. I sat with him in the hallway for a couple of minutes when he was with family and the others, McGlinchey said. Bo and I are close. Bo, Izzy, and my wife, Brooke, and I are all close, just like everybody else is. It hurts. I've obviously texted him a bunch and checked in with him, just letting him know that I'm here for him, whenever he needs. But he was in great spirits. I think he's made to handle things like this. He's just as tough as they come, and he'll be back better than ever when this is all said and done. McGlinchey called the loss of Nix heartbreaking and the crappy part of our game. But he is very optimistic about Stidham and touched upon how good he has looked in practices and game action for the Broncos. Stidham had an impressive 2025 preseason for Denver, although he faced reserves in the 2 games he played. In games at San Francisco and at home against Arizona, he completed 30 of 38 passes for 78.9% for 376 yards with 4 touchdowns and no interceptions. He led all NFL quarterbacks in preseason with a passer rating of 143. This guy just loves football, McGlinchey said, and he's been absorbing everything that we've been doing. He's been ready for his opportunity whenever that might come. He stays in his routine every single day for 3 years straight, not knowing when that opportunity is going to come around, and I know that our team and the rest of our staff and everybody has the utmost confidence in Jarrett to play well. Not everybody has a quarterback waiting in the wings as talented as Jarrett. In the biggest game of his life, he will be driving the Stitty Bus on Sunday. Emmy nominated. Springs native explores veterans' mental health in documentary. Written by Jen Molson. And the story begins with two photos. The first shows the individual in the story sitting in his warehouse, and there's a camera pointed at him. Behind him is a wall with pallets that have been painted black, and there's an American flag hung from that. And in front of all that looks like a still for distilling alcohol. The individual is a Caucasian male. He's wearing a black short sleeve button up shirt with a black t-shirt on underneath. He's got jeans on. His left arm has a half tattoo from his elbow up to his shoulder. And the caption reads, Lauren Richie's new documentary, Bombs to Booze, was nominated for a 2025 Heartland Emmy. And the other photo shows Mike Gerard is the founder and owner of 300 Days Distilling in Monument. And this photo shows Mike wearing blue jeans and a gray casual button-up shirt with either the logo of his company or a name tag above his left breast pocket. He has a short-cropped beard, short-cropped hair. He's smiling into the camera. There's a bottle of his alcohol in front of him, and he's holding a glass with it. And now to the story. It's no secret that many veterans struggle with the return to civilian life. One statistic is particularly troubling. 117,000 vets lost their lives to suicide over the course of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, said Mike Gerard, a retired U.S. Army Explosive Ordnance Disposal, EOD, specialist. They say with all the guys who got out and separated and have fallen off the radar, that number could be as high as 300,000 to 400,000. 7,000 were lost in combat-related events. Gerard, founder and owner of 300 Days Distilling in Monument, is the core of the story in Boom Bombs to Booze, a new 2025 documentary about Colorado Springs native Lauren Richie. The locally produced film about the Colorado veteran community was nominated for a 2025 Heartland Emmy and is available to stream on Amazon Prime Video. Richie's 40-minute film seeks to break down the stigma of having to remain strong and refuse mental health help, lest they appear weak, that many military members and vets face during and post-service. She interviewed several vets in the Pikes Peak region, including Gerard, two former EOD technicians, and an Army officer who worked with Gerard in Afghanistan. They shared their stories of transitioning out of the military, how difficult it was, and how they managed to eventually find an improved quality of life through therapies, including alternative modalities like ketamine infusions, equine therapy, and hyperbaric chambers. You'll get through the mission, and then you can deal with whatever happened. I heard that a lot, said Richie, who graduated from Lewis Palmer High School and Colorado State University in Fort Collins. But then comes another mission, and another, and then comes a time when you realize you'll never reach out for help. We wanted to question that line of thinking and make sure people knew it didn't make you any less of a person to reach out for help. And there are a lot of options out there. After 23 years and 4 combat deployments, Gerard came face to face with the blank page of life after military duty. The surrealness of civilian life was made more difficult for him by a body racked with arthritis and pain. But unlike many other vets, Gerard had a good support system, his wife and daughter, and he was able to build and nurture his moonshine business by taking a 3-gallon pressure cooker IED, improvised explosive device, his team defused in Afghanistan, and turning it into a still. He opened his distillery more than a decade ago and uses it as a vehicle to advocate for veterans' mental health. It's instilled in your brain to be a charge forward into danger type of personality. When you're deployed and working overseas, you thrive on chaos. And when you get out, that doesn't exist anymore, Gerard said. You're trying to transition out in a meaningful way. Seeking help is the last thing you do. You don't want to be perceived as weak. If you don't feel like you have purpose, you can go down some dark holes. A common trajectory is a stop at the Department of Veterans Affairs, where vets get some sort of diagnosis, pills, and sometimes referrals for talk therapy, Gerard says. Gerard's got a different approach to helping vets, and it comes through his nonprofit, Zero K, which helps connect them to other nonprofits and organizations that provide alternative therapies. Most don't know such options exist. Our goal is to let them know it's available, and it wouldn't cost thousands to get into treatments, Gerard said. Most are nonprofits, or costs that don't come out of a vet's pockets. This is no dig on the VA. It's overtaxed. So, many people are coming in, and a lot of times, vets need more than just a referral. And to sit in front of a 24-year-old therapist who has never been through what you've been through. The military and mental health have always been close to Richie's heart, as her father was in the U.S. Air Force. She now lives in California and is working on another project with a similar focus. I learned a lot about the stigma within the military, she said. The message of reaching out for help doesn't exclusively apply to the military. It applies to everyone experiencing mental health issues. Is pardon for Tina Peters coming? Polis confirms he is weighing options. This was written by Michael Karlick and Luigi Del Puerto. Sorry, Luigi. And the story begins with a photo of Peters. She's standing outdoors. There's a tree that is void of leaves behind her, so I assume it's the fall time. She's wearing a gray blazer and a black turtleneck. Her silver hair is shoulder length with bangs in the front. She's holding a microphone and she is speaking into it. And the caption reads, "Then Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters addresses supporters on December 1st, 2022, outside Colorado Republican Party headquarters in Greenwood Village." And now to the story. Governor Jared Polis on Friday strongly indicated he is considering clemency for Tina Peters, the former county clerk convicted of a security breach at her election office. When pressed about the matter, Polis didn't offer an explicit answer, but he confirmed that he will be reviewing the applications from a batch of prisoners, and Peters is one of them. As I've said, yeah, I am looking at all clemency applications. I think that her sentence is on the harsh side, you know, nonviolent, first offender, but I have many that we're looking at, he said. He didn't directly answer when asked if he had heard from President Donald Trump, who has been pressing for Peters' release. Ultimately, Polis said, the decision is up to him as Colorado's governor. People have opinions, but it really doesn't matter. What matters is my opinion as the person who grants it. I mean, there's been ones I've done where people said it was Kim Kardashian trying to tell me something, he said. Polis was referring to his 2022 decision to commute the 110-year sentence of a truck driver, whose actions in 2019 led to a fiery 28-car pileup that killed four and injured several others. Kim Kardashian West, the reality TV star and businesswoman, was among those seeking the commutation. Polis said his office is accepting clemency applications through April for pardons he could take by the end of the year, adding, there's a lot of groundwork involved in reviewing each case. Last week, Peters seemed poised to walk away from the state's Court of Appeals with her criminal convictions largely intact, even as a three-judge appellate panel raised concerns about her sentence and one specific conviction. Peters, a Republican who served one term following her 2018 election, is serving a roughly 9-year prison sentence for a mixture of felony and misdemeanor offenses related to a security breach of her office's voting equipment. Broadly, jurors found that Peters had used deception to enable unauthorized access to a quote-unquote trusted build update of her county's election software, and that videos and images from the update were later posted online. During an unusually long oral argument session on Wednesday, an interesting dynamic emerged. While the appellate judges were highly skeptical and even confused about Peters's broad arguments that she had no criminal liability, their targeted questioning of the prosecution suggested that Peters may ultimately prevail on a handful of issues. Last year, the U.S. Department of Justice asserted its interest in Peters's attempt to be released on bond while her appeal proceeded, an unprecedented and ultimately unsuccessful move. Then, in late 2025, Trump issued a pardon for Peters's state convictions. Legal scholars and others described the move as symbolic, as Peters was convicted of state crimes. Judge warns against expansive use of post-9/11 rule in immigration detentions. Written by Michael Karlick. A federal judge concluded last week that the government applied a 9/11-era regulation to a man in immigration detention in violation of his constitutional rights, in seemingly the first decision out of Colorado addressing the increased use of the quote-unquote automatic stay to block release on bond. In a January 12th order, U.S. Magistrate Judge Susan Prose further suggested the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is invoking the automatic stay far more frequently than the regulation envisions, keeping people detained even after they have been granted release. Although the court need not reach this issue here, the court is also not convinced that DHS has stayed within the bounds of its intended authority in recent months, she wrote. As the government has pushed to apprehend and detain people in immigration custody in record numbers, there has been a wave of litigation over the government's authority to keep people in custody, pending the resolution of their immigration proceedings. To date, trial judges have overwhelmingly concluded that the government is wrong about the scope of its authority to detain people without bond. Accordingly, judges have ordered hearings for immigration judges to decide whether to release detainees who are not a flight risk or a danger to the community. However, according to data reported by Documented in December, the government has begun blocking immigration judges' release decisions by invoking the automatic stay. As a regulation enacted soon after September 11, 2001, to, quote, prevent the release of aliens who may pose a threat to national security, end quote, the automatic stay halts the release of a detainee for at least 90 days. If the Attorney General intervenes, the stay can extend for the entirety of the custody proceedings, and the immigration judge's release decision will not be implemented. The government invoked the automatic stay 877 times over 12 weeks beginning in July, compared to 3 times total between 2020 and 2024, Documented reported. In the case before Prose, Dennis Mirchen Pacheco filed a petition for habeas corpus, which is a long-standing legal tool to challenge one's confinement. Although the federal rules largely shield the filings in Mirchen Pacheco's case from public view, Prose's order indicated he came to the United States from Ecuador in 2021 as a child, after which the government approved his U.S. resident mother as his sponsor. In 2023, the government initiated deportation proceedings against Mirchen Pacheco. He then filed an asylum application. In August, immigration authorities took him into custody and moved him to the privately run detention center in Aurora. Immigration Judge Melanie Corrin determined Mirchen Pacheco was not subject to mandatory detention and could be released while his case proceeded. She set a $25,000 bond, which his family paid. The Department of Homeland Security then appealed the decision, invoking the automatic stay. In her order, Pros reiterated that Merchan Pacheco was eligible for bond, and she declined to review the immigration judge's determination. She also rejected the government's argument that, because detention during deportation proceedings is constitutionally permissible, Merchan Pacheco's specific detention was permissible. Turning to the automatic stay, Pros worried about the Department of Homeland Security's reliance on the procedural tool beyond its intended purpose. For instance, the court notes that despite the Attorney General's statement that the automatic stay provision exists to enable DHS's to invoke the automatic stay with respect to aliens whom it believes are potentially dangerous or are at risk of absconding prior to the conclusion of removal proceedings, or whose cases DHS believes otherwise present important considerations, she wrote, "No such concerns have been cited here, and it is clear that over the last few months, the automatic stay provision has been invoked across a much broader array of cases than this language would support." Analyzing the required factors, Pros concluded the government did not have a strong interest in continuing Merchan Pacheco's detention, given the immigration judge's finding that he was suitable for release. Moreover, she cautioned that the automatic stay gives, quote, the losing party in the bond hearing, end quote, a path to override an immigration judge's release decision. She ordered his release on the $25,000 bond. Laura Loon, an attorney with the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network, who was not involved in the case, said Pros' order was the first, to her knowledge, addressing the automatic stay's legality in Colorado. This scheme severely undermines the authority of the immigration courts and serves to try to strip people of the right to discretionary release from custody, she said. Pros' observation about the government's use of the stay seemingly calls into question whether U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is acting in good faith and within the bounds of the regulatory scheme. Immigration attorney Hans Meyer said he recently litigated a case involving an automatic stay, but the litigation was resolved on different grounds. He believed challenges to the automatic stay will become more prevalent, similar to the wave of litigation over mandatory detention. Meyer agreed with Pros' concern that the government is using the automatic stay as a matter of course, regardless of the justification. They're using their arguments against people without the wherewithal or firepower to push back. To us, it pretty clearly seems like a use of the legal system to advance the deportation machine, he said. The U.S. Attorney's Office for Colorado declined to comment on Pros' characterization of the government's conduct. ICE's Denver office did not respond to emailed questions about the automatic stay. The case is Merchan Pacheco v. Nome et al. Grocery delivery expanding to commissaries on Fort Carson and Peterson. Written by Mary Shin. Commissary shoppers now can order groceries for delivery from shops on Fort Carson and Peterson Space Force Base. The new service is part of a nationwide expansion by the Defense Commissary Agency across 62 stores, according to a news release. The agency was inspired to start the service after hosting focus groups where young, single, enlisted service members and disabled veterans and their caregivers provided feedback, according to a news release. "We are striving to anticipate our patrons' needs and do what it takes to be their grocery provider of choice," said John E. Hall, Defense Commissary Agency Director and CEO, in the release. The delivery service was piloted at 8 commissaries starting in 2022 and will be available at all 62 originally identified stores by the end of January. The agency could expand delivery to the remaining 108 stores it runs in the continental U.S. under its current contract, but no timeline for the larger expansion was provided in the news release. Drivers will drop groceries on doorsteps located within 20 miles of the commissaries for a fee. A shopper 10 miles from the store would pay $17.75 for a delivery, and those between 10 and 20 miles would pay $31.25, according to the agency. Shoppers will need a Department of Defense identification number to complete their online purchases for delivery. At Fort Carson and Peterson Space Force Base, deliveries will be available Monday through Friday. More details are available at shop.commissaries.com/delivery. And I believe this will be my last story for you today. Will Jerome Powell leave Fed in May? And the story begins with a photo of Powell. He's standing behind the lectern in a gray suit with a white tie and a white shirt and a lavender tie. His gray hair is cut into a short style above the ears. He's wearing tortoiseshell black glasses, and his hands are held up in front of him like he's holding something. And the caption reads, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell speaks at the Federal Reserve on December 10th in Washington. And this story is out of Washington. The Justice Department's investigation into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has brought heightened attention to a key drama that will play out at the central bank in the coming months. Will Powell leave the Fed when his term as chair ends, or will he take the unusual step of remaining as a governor? Powell's term as Fed chair finishes on May 15, but because of the central bank's complex structure, he has a separate term as one of seven members of its governing board that lasts until January 31, 2028. Historically, nearly all Fed chairs have stepped down from the board when they are no longer chair, but Powell could be the first in nearly 50 years to stay on as a governor. Many Fed watchers believe that the criminal investigation into Powell's testimony about cost overruns for Fed building renovations was intended to intimidate him out of taking that step. If Powell stays on the board, it would deny the White House a chance to gain a majority, undercutting the Trump administration's efforts to seize greater control over what has for decades been an institution largely insulated from day-to-day politics. I find it very difficult to see Powell leaving before midnight on January 31st, 2028, said David Wilcox, a former top economist at the Fed and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. This is a mortal threat to the governance structure of the Fed as we've known it for 90 years. And I think that Powell does take that threat exceedingly seriously, and therefore will believe that it is his solemn duty to continue to occupy his seat on the Board of Governors. Powell, 72, was appointed as Fed Chair by Trump in 2018 and must step down from the position in May because his second four-year term is ending. He has declined several times to comment on his plans beyond that when asked by reporters. A spokesperson declined to comment for this story. Trump has sought to push out Powell before his time is up, attacking him for not cutting rates as sharply as the president wants, particularly in light of ongoing concerns about high costs for groceries, utilities, and housing that have remained a salient political issue, even as inflation has cooled. Last Tuesday, Trump highlighted that mortgage rates have declined in the past year. If I had the help of the Fed, it would be easier, he said, but that jerk will be gone soon. Or maybe not. Here is a look at the impacts of whether or not Powell stays on the board could have. What happens if Powell stays on the board? Trump said last week that he hopes to name a new Fed chair in the next few weeks, but that could get held up by the criminal investigation of Powell. Several Republican senators, including at least two on the Banking Committee, who would have to approve Trump's nominees to the Fed, have expressed skepticism that Powell committed crimes during his testimony last June regarding the Fed's $2.5 billion renovation of two office buildings, a project that Trump has criticized as excessive. That testimony is the subject of subpoenas sent to the Fed by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pierro. Senator Tom Tillis, a North Carolina Republican, said he would not vote for any Fed nominees until the legal cloud around Powell is resolved. That would be enough to delay a nomination from getting out of the banking committee. If no new chair of the Fed's board has been confirmed by May 15th, then Powell could remain in that post until a replacement has been confirmed. As a result, the Fed might not cut interest rates anywhere near as quickly as Trump wants. If Powell stays on as a governor, even after he is no longer chair, Trump could still name someone to lead the Fed, but that would give him a total of 3 appointments on the board, including 2 from his first term and short of a majority. So, even if Trump nominates a chair who seeks to do the president's bidding regarding interest rates, that person, quote, would have very little persuasive power with his colleagues, end quote, said Wilcox, who is also director of research at Bloomberg Economics. Powell, along with other members of the Fed's 19-member interest rate setting committee, could outvote the new chair. That hasn't happened since 1986. What happens if Powell leaves the board? In that case, Trump could nominate a 4th person to the board and gain a majority. He could even then add a 5th if the Supreme Court allows his attempt to fire Governor Lisa Cook to proceed. The High Court will hear her case on Wednesday. A majority on the board would enable the White House to make sweeping changes to the Fed. Trump's Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, has advocated numerous reforms to reduce the central bank's influence in the economy and financial markets. Trump's majority on the Fed's board could also remove some of the presidents of the 12 regional banks who are members of the Fed's rate-setting committee. The New York Fed president has a vote on the committee, and 4 others vote on a rotating basis. Several of those bank presidents have expressed opposition to the deep rate cuts that Trump has demanded. The Board of Governors could seek to have them fired if a chair wanted to do so. What past Fed chairs have done. While nearly all Fed chairs have left the Board of Governors before their terms were up, there is some precedent for Powell to stay. In 1978, then-chair Arthur Burns stayed on the board for about 3 weeks after his chairmanship ended. But in 1948, then-Fed chairman Mariner Eccles remained as a governor for 3 years after finishing as chair, in part because President Harry Truman asked him to remain. In 1951, however, he played a key role in undercutting the Truman administration in a dispute over interest rates, which led the Fed Treasury Accord that established the modern Fed as a largely independent institution. Eccles became a symbol of Fed independence, though some academics say that reputation is overstated. The Fed's principal office building, currently under renovation and at the center of the criminal investigation of Powell, is named after him. Truman then appointed a Treasury official, William McChesney Martin, to the Fed chairmanship and assumed would do his bidding. Yet Martin defied Truman and raised interest rates. Years later, Truman ran into Martin in New York City and called him a traitor. The Fed's second office building in Washington is named after Martin. So, it's a cautionary tale, also for Trump, thinking he's going to get his own Fed chair in there, said Lev Menard, a law professor at Columbia University who studies the Fed. Martin didn't do what Truman wanted. And with that, I conclude this edition of the Tuesday Colorado Springs Gazette. Thank you for joining me. My name is Brian Juergens.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.